All right. Okay. Erev Tov, everybody. Okay. We can start. Okay. Bakasha. Okay.
May 1st, 2023. Many emails. I'll get to a lot of them. Not today. I don't have time because I want to really get to the stuff with the Rav. But we spoke last class about sports on Shabbos. So one of you wants to know about what is Rav Kook's view about soccer on Shabbos. So I'll get to the whole Rav Kook issue and what he thought about sports on Shabbos. It was a bit of an issue, created a controversy. So I'll get to that. Hold on. The matter of the Rav, how he related to Talmidim. We probably have some Talmidim in the 50s and 60s versus the 70s. It's an interesting topic. It's even discussed in Gopin's new book. Gopin just came out with a book. Here it is. A short book. You can see it. A Masa HaRav in commemoration of the 120th birthday and the 30th yahrzeit of the Rav by Mendy Gopin. It's a book of Maiseo stories. I mean, interesting stories. Look, the Rav is big enough that you can have stories and also have, you know, detailed academic studies about him, not to mention obviously Torah studies. So I will deal with that. Also, I want to show you something, not this class, but I'll whet your appetite. The Rav in his relationship with other Rosh Yeshiva. There actually was one Rosh Yeshiva that YU. Well, let me, since I mentioned it, hold on. Let me show you something here. I'll leave it, and but I won't explain it today. I'm going to explain it. Well, actually, I don't want to because in the title I give it away. But there is one Rosh Yeshiva at YU who YU has totally removed from its institutional memory. They even came out with a document about 10 years ago with pictures and biographies of all the Rosh Yeshiva, and one Rosh Yeshiva is missing. And he's not just a Rosh Yeshiva from a long time ago. He's a Rosh Yeshiva that I bet people listening right now had him as their Rebbe. So I will explain that whole story there, and Rabbi Kelman knows it. So I'll explain, well, I'll show it to you, the document, and I'll explain why Rav Volk, who was, he's not one of these minor Rosh Yeshiva. He was like the one right below when he went to the Rav. Rabbi Rekefet was in his year for 2 years. He writes about him. Why Rav Volk has been removed from YU's institutional memory. I think it's a disgrace, actually. He could have a machokas with the Rav, but he trained for decades, Torah students at Torah. He taught Torah for decades at YU. And he's a Mechaber Sfarim. He's one of the greatest of the Rosh Yeshiva in terms of learning. So we'll talk about that. But I'll get to that, as I say, in a future class. For now, just a few things I want to get to. Here, let me show you this. I just saw this last Shabbos. Not the last Shabbos, the Shabbos before. I thought you'd find it cute. Remember a few weeks ago, we spoke about the name Dorshav, and I told you this Pasuk Zed Dor Dorshav, which then became Dorshav. That is, this is a useless generation. I saw a Hasidic vort on this. So it says Zed Dor Dorshav Mevakshei Fanecha Yaakov Sela. Rav Meir of Primashon. I just came across this. He says he gave his interpretation as follows: there are some sometimes you have a tzaddik for a Hasidic Rebbe. A tzaddik means a Rebbe. So there's some Hasidic Rebbes who they only take money. You know, when you come to them, you give a pidyon. They don't give money. They don't give tzedakah. They take it all. They want to live the good life. So he says about a certain tzaddik who would not give any tzedakah, he only took. You know how Rav Meir of Primashon interpreted? He applied this verse to him. Zeh dor dor shav. In other words, this is a dor shav. This is a useless generation. Why? Because also the mevakshei panecha, that is the ones who seek your face, God, Yaakov, not Yaakov Sela, Yaakov Sela, Yaakov Sela, that is with a cuff, that is they prevent money from being given. So, that's cute. Sela, as you know, in the Talmud is a rabbinic, is a term used, is a money term. Last class, I spoke about the Rav, Lonely Man of Faith, and I wasn't sure if Walter Wurzberger was the editor. He indeed was the editor. So I checked at that time in the mid-60s. Also, I just happened to see this. I went back to the Rav's essay Catharsis that appears in, why can I get to the top of it here? Here it is. In spring 1978, it's delivered at MIT on November 18th, 1962. That's the talk. This is, if you recall, the Rav, we had the letter in which the Rav was speaking about Brother Daniel, and he said he gave a talk at MIT. The letter is dated Tevet, so figure January of 1963, and he says, a few weeks ago, I gave a talk at MIT, and they asked me about this issue, Brother Daniel. So that's the talk, Catharsis, his essay. Also, I listened to the class in the car the other day, last week, and right at the end, I was saying about, you know, that Rav Soloveitchik speaks about the fact that we're part of this world, but we also are separate from it. That's relevant, obviously, to sports. You know, we don't get everything that we want. I realized afterwards that maybe some of you were not aware of what I was alluding to. So let me share it with you now. It's pretty famous from the Rav, where it says that Avraham, when he lived among the Hittites, what does it say? Ger v'toshav anochi. So the Rav elaborates, what does ger v'toshav mean? That, you know, on the one hand, you're a toshav, you live among them, you share the same concerns, which we do, but you're also a ger. You're also separate. You have your own ideas. I mean, look, all of us grow up, I grew up, so Friday night, I tell this to the classes that I teach at university, teach a Judaism course or world religions, that basically I share their culture, but I have certain lacuna. So for example, growing up, I never watched TV Friday night or Saturday morning, so I never saw Dallas. You know, that was, for people my generation, who shot JR, that was a big thing. A whole culture that existed on Saturday, Friday night, I wasn't part of. So we're a ger, but we're also a toshav. We also spoke about last class about mixed seating and Rav Moshe's point and the Rav's point about this being daraisa. So what is this about? What do you mean it's daraisa? How could it be daraisa? Rabbi Kelman made a comment about that as well. So I looked up, first of all, Rav Kook. In Orach Mishpat, he also says it's daraisa, men and women not sitting together. But he's not talking about machitza per se. He's just talking about that because men need to be separate from women. They can't create an environment where they're mixing. But that, of course, would apply to other circumstances as well. But Rav Moshe in his tshuva, Nidras Moshe, Rabbi Kelman points out that it says that originally it wasn't this way, and then they changed it to separate them, send the women upstairs. Rav Moshe develops the notion that how could you have changed the original way of doing it? The rabbis wouldn't have had the authority, or the pre-rabbis. It had to be of Torah. So what he says basically is that they derived it. That's what he says, that they derived it, and once they derived it, it was a Torah. In other words, they derived it from the Torah. So it is daraisa. Just because we know lots of things the rabbis derive are daraisa. It doesn't have to be explicit in the Torah. It doesn't have to even want to be 613 mitzvot. If you derive it from the Torah, at least according to most, it has the status of a Torah law. That's what Rav Moshe says, that once they derive this, then it's a they couldn't have it couldn't have been a rabbinic law. It has to be a Torah law. Maybe that's the Rav's position as well. Rav Regensburg sees it differently. I'm looking in Litvin's book. Rav Regensburg sees it as a siyag. He sees the whole machitza thing as a rabbinic institution to keep the men and women focused on the prayers. But Rav Moshe and the Rav, so that answers, I think, Rabbi Kelman's point that, well, you know, the rabbis, it sure looks like they're making a decree here, but if they're making the decree deriving it from the Torah, as Rav Moshe explains, and you might not find it convincing, but that is Rav Moshe's argument. Okay, let's pick up now. Maybe we'll finish with the letters today. If not, we'll finish next class. If you recall, we were speaking about, I was giving the introduction to the Rav's position on Mechitza, how important it is. And there's one more thing I want to show you before we get to the Rav's his letter, the Rav's letter to Marvin Fox, and that's found in Helfgott's book. By the way, the stuff on Machitza and Helfgott's book, most of it comes out of the Litvin book. But on page 133 and on, what you have here is a translation of the third of a 10-part interview that the Rav gave. I don't know if it was if this was done at one time or a few times. I said it's an interview because they phrased it, I remember, in the Yiddish as an interview, but I don't think it was an interview per se. I think they asked him questions and he replied. That's what it was, not an interview. There were 10 parts to this. Two of them are found in the Helfgott book. The other eight, all 10 are found in the David Fishman book, that volume of Yiddish drushos of the Rav that I used a few classes ago. But as far as I know, only two of the eight have been translated into English. So if we have any Yiddish readers here, here you have some important stuff from the Rav that's never been translated into English. There's some other important things of the Rav that have never been translated into English, so it's worth translating. But what does he say in this? This is 1954, right in the middle of the time that Orthodoxy is on the defensive. Shuls are opening up, quote, Orthodox shuls, not machitzas. Shuls are getting rid of the machitzas. Orthodox musmachim are taking rabbinates in these shuls. So, and the Rav says that lately there's been a great increase in the number of synagogues where men and women sit together. And he says the people who go to these synagogues regard themselves as Orthodox. So, here's the question that the Rav was asked. Should Orthodox Judaism consider these synagogues as an inevitable development and reconcile to them? Or should we be militantly opposed to them? There were plenty of rabbis and individuals who thought we should reconcile to them. To give you an example of a leading figure, Rabbi David de Sola Pool, rabbi, or they called him minister, but he's also a musmach of the Sherith Israel, the Spanish and Portuguese synagogue, said, although he has an article called Judaism in the Synagogue and a book called The American Jew, it is edited by Oscar Janowski on page 35 and 54, he says that a synagogue can be Orthodox even if the lattice work, the ladies' gallery, either has lattice work or doesn't have it. And then he says, however, Orthodoxy in America has new innovations. The late Friday night service, we'll get to that today, the removal of the women's gallery, confirmation. He says these would have shocked the worshipers a generation ago. Today, such practices are accepted in numerous congregations. Distinctly American standards of Orthodoxy are emerging. American Orthodoxy may yet succeed in harmonizing unquestioning faith with modern living. So what the Sola Pool was saying here is that the machitza is getting rid of the machitza is something that Orthodoxy might come to accept as a tolerate it as something that's an inevitable development. He doesn't see it as absolutely inappropriate. He says it's an innovation, but they're accepted, and Orthodoxy might come to accept it. I have a viewpoint. I know Rabbi Kilman's heard me say this, and I hope it doesn't come off as heretical, but I think it's true historically. I believe that had it not been for the Rav, and had you had Orthodox synagogues without machitzas, where the people were observant, in fact, I'll go further. If you had the conservative movement, the early conservative movement, where the only difference is the machitza, if they were Shomrei Torah mitzvos, and the only difference was the machitza, I have no doubt that they would have been accepted. Look, we accept Hasidim. They have certain things which are not in accord with halacha. I mean, they don't daven, some of them, at the proper zman. We accept them. If you can imagine a community where all they did differently was no machitza, but were pious in every other area, in all the areas, it's hard to see how that would have not been regarded as, even if you think it's inappropriate, just... that's their way of doing it. We don't accept it. That's a cool one. We don't accept. According to Satmar, you can't be in any of our shuls because you can't see the women at all. It's absolutely forbidden. But they know that these are Orthodox synagogues. But so that I'm sure that would have developed. The problem was that both for the Orthodox and for these shuls, these non-machitza shuls, they weren't really observant, both of them. The non-machitza shuls, the average person wasn't that observant, and the conservative synagogues, of course they weren't. And the Rav made a big deal, even without the Rav making a big deal about it, it would have been a problem. But with the Rav, he really put his feet in the sand. Okay, so the Rav raises the question, and the Rav says as follows. Listen to this. He says, a young man moved to a suburb of Boston. The only shul within walking distance was men and women sitting together. He asked me, that is the Rav, what to do on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, because he hadn't entered the synagogue. But on Yom Kippur, he didn't want to stay at home. I said to him, it's better to stay at home Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur and not step foot in that synagogue. I'm not sure why he can't go to another town where there's shuls, kosher shuls that he can stay in. Why is he stuck staying in that place on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur? But the people go away Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur all the time. People come to Scranton. Graduates of the Scranton yeshiva from the 60s, 70s, they still come back, just like they come back to other yeshivas. But whatever, that's what he told him. So even Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur don't step foot in the synagogue in the mixed seating. We're talking mixed seating now. Mixed seating for the Rav does not have Kedushas Beis HaKnesses. It's not considered a synagogue. A synagogue with separate seating, but no machitza, that's a problem. But it's still a Beis HaKnesses. And the Rav never said that you should not go in such a synagogue. A few days later, he says that the man telephoned him again. He met the man who was going to blow shofar. And this man said to him, if you don't come, you're not going to hear shofar because he's not doing it again. And he says, the young man implored me, you know, tkias ha-shofar, give me permission to enter the synagogue at least for half hour. The Rav says, I hesitated not for a moment, but directed that he remain at home. It would be better not to hear the shofar than to enter a synagogue whose sanctity has been profaned. Okay, I have all sorts of questions, but you can say you're not supposed to ask a kasha on a maisa. Number one, why couldn't the guy, if it's so important, he could get a hotel room. He doesn't need a hotel room. The Rav can make one phone call, and the guy could be staying in a house in Brookline. Okay, so maybe he has an old mother he has to stay home with. And you can come up with some reason. Is it so hard to learn to blow the shofar? And in the whole town, there's only one person who can blow the shofar? In other words, it just seems like it's – I'm not saying it's not a true story, but the Rav's using it here to make a point. Shofar is a mitzvah d'oraisa. We have to hear the shofar. The Rav says, do not step foot into that synagogue to hear the shofar, even though the shofar is different than the synagogue. Granted, the synagogue is not the place of it's not a Beis Knesses. But you don't need to hear shofar in a Beis Knesses. You can hear shofar. You could be walking outside and hear shofar. By the way, the Rav doesn't say to him, go stand outside. We'll see today when the Rav had to go to a conservative synagogue, he stood outside. I guess today, without the windows being open, you wouldn't hear it outside. But even to walk into the synagogue, not to take part in the service, just to hear it. So where does the Rav get this? It seems to be a bit extreme. I heard from Rav Parnas, Rav Yehuda Parnas. He said that this is hara'asha, that the Rav, this was an emergency measure that only a gadol like the Rav could do. That this is in the midst of the battle of orthodoxy and conservative, and actually orthodox and orthodox, mechitzalis orthodox, that a stand need to have been taken. And even though it's a, quote, orthodox synagogue with maybe the Rav's own Talmud as the rabbi there, everyone else, he's saying, do not step foot in there, even to hear tkias ha-shofar. And so what's the basis of this? Rav Parnas says it's harasha. It's an emergency measure because based on strict halachic argumentation, you would conclude otherwise. You would say, go in, hear the shofar. The guy blowing the shofar is an acceptable person, no doubt, presumably. And you hear the shofar, maybe the rabbi's blowing the shofar. He's certainly acceptable. The Rav says no. So is Rav Parnas correct that it's harasha? Perhaps that in a different era where it wasn't this battle, the Rav would have been able to be mekel. I can tell you that, although I don't know if this is a proof, because the Rav's student, one of the big Talmidim of the Rav, Talmidim of the Rav don't need to follow everything the Rav says, but I can tell you 100%, I know it is a fact, that one of the big Talmidim of the Rav gave a heter for a young man whose father was a rabbi in a conservative shul to daven in the shul with his father, even though it's mixed seating, It's one of the old-fashioned conservative shuls where the sitter is the same. It's not egalitarian. And this Talmud of the Rav said to this person, just do it for kibud avim. Just find a place where there aren't any women, and you stand there and you do your davening. And when you're home, that's what you should do. Would the Rav say that? I'm going to complicate the story of the Rav in a little bit by showing you things that you wouldn't expect from what we just saw here. But this is a famous statement of the Rav, repeated again and again. And in fact, every year, for many years, the Agudas Rabbonim of America would come out with a statement in the Allgemeiner and the Jewish Week, and they would announce, I mean, in the Jewish Week, they take out these big ads, many of you have seen it, that according to Halacha, you should stay home. It's better not even to hear Tiyas HaShofar than to step foot into a non-Orthodox synagogue. The problem was that these ads, when the Rav spoke, he's speaking to Torah Jews. The ads in the Jewish Week are, the Jewish Week is a general paper. So when, just think when a non-Orthodox Jew opens up the paper and they see that their synagogue is basically like a church and you shouldn't step foot into it. They didn't, I don't know if they used that term, but they said, you know, it's forbidden to step foot into it. They think that the Orthodox are a bunch of fanatics. The Rav wasn't saying this to the members of Rabbi Shubo's synagogue. He was saying it to, Orthodox Jews. The Rav himself said in that letter we saw, and I'm going to show you more of a Shubo in a few minutes, that this is important for communal gathering. So the Rav was not speaking to the non-Orthodox. And the idea that you take this position and then just announce it to the non-Orthodox, what are the non-Orthodox going to do on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur if they don't go to shul? They're going to say, I'm going to watch TV. You know, it's a whole different... So I really think that that was malpractice of these people, Rabbi Hollander and others, to tell the world at large, look, I know plenty of people today in the non-Orthodox world, they didn't go to shul during COVID, and now they still don't go to shul in Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, and they're happy doing that. You know, now they're losing their last connection. The Rav continues in this. He says that mingling is forbidden according to Halacha. He says it's a Torah law. He says that this is, there's a long history to this. He continues by saying that family pews is in contradiction to the Jewish spirit of prayer. The old Protestant idea, the family that prays together stays together. The Rav says when you pray, you're not about your family. You're not about the people you're with. It's between you and God. And therefore, we separate. During prayer, man must feel alone, removed, isolated. He must then regard the Creator as an only friend from whom one alone can hope for support and consolation. Very interesting, very much in line with the Rav's view of loneliness and connection to God. But I dare say that the average Jew in the synagogue, Orthodox Jew, does not feel alone, removed, and isolated. And I don't even think he aspires to that. I don't even think the rabbis would tell you to aspire to this. They simply would say that we're separated from women, and because of the sexual tension and all that, you want to, you know, deal with that. You can do another time at the Kiddush. But in shul, you have to be focused on just davening. And but that's the, you know, this is very much in line with Rav's understanding of these sort of matters. He says the presence of women among men or of men among women. I'm glad he says that. Because if you've ever been to the Boston Rebbe Shul, you know that the mechitza was a one-way glass. So the women could see the men and the men couldn't see the women. So everyone would say, what? Why does it only go one way? But in Lincoln Square, remember the old Lincoln Square? I don't know if it's a new Lincoln Square building, where it was just a window. Both could see each other. But really, according to Ramosha, according to the standard approach, the issue of mechitza is not about seeing. It's about mixing. There's a contradiction of the Rambam. In the Parish of Mishnah, he seems to say it's about seeing. And that's why in Hungary and certain places in Germany, the mechitza was such that men couldn't see the women. But and then elsewhere in the Mishnah Torah, it's about mixing. And therefore, that's our mechitzas. Look, there's a question of how tall they have to be. But the idea is that you can't mix. You can't obviously walk through. You can't have connections. But it's not about seeing. Then he says, Orthodoxy must mobilize all its forces and wage an indefatigable battle against the Christianization of the synagogue. He calls it Christianization. He says, I have no other word for it. He says that this process of Christianizing the synagogue is being accomplished by people who possess no sense of halacha and what prayer is. They have the arrogance to wreck principles and traditions, which have become hallowed through blood and tears. And he says he doesn't think the battle will be lost. He doesn't think that sitting men and women together is a progressive idea which should appeal to men of culture. He says that an American Jew has a lot of common sense and intellectual honesty. And if they really understand the purpose of the mechitza, they will see that it's not about oppressing women or anything. It's about connecting to God. And he concludes, we haven't yet lost the battle. He says, we have not yet lost the battle, for we have not yet begun to fight. We have but abandoned the synagogue, much as the French abandoned Paris before the Germans fired the very first shot. So basically, he says, we haven't begun to fight. We've abandoned it without a fight. If we lose the synagogue, we lose the strategic positions. He says, he ends it, quoting Psalms, gird thy sword, ride on in behalf of truth. So the Rav says, we haven't yet begun to fight. We're going to fight. This is a fundamental matter. And, he has one more letter on, this in the Helfgott book where he wrote to, I don't know who this person is, in 54, Abraham Lebo in Manhattan. And he says to him that, Dr. Lebo, you make the mistake, or I shouldn't say him, but we shouldn't make the mistake that has led many Jews to leave Orthodoxy. That is, we have to distinguish between the shortcomings of individuals or the deplorable features of a service and the evils which destroy the very essence of Jewish prayer. Yes, you can go into an Orthodox synagogue, people are talking, there's chaos, but that's a problem, he says. That's a deplorable feature. But if you put in mixed seating, thinking that that's going to be a better synagogue, he says that's an evil that destroys the very essence of Jewish prayer. And, okay, so these are all the letters the Rav has about, that I know of, about mixed seating in prayer. Until that is, I published the Fox letter. But before we get to that, I want to tell you a bit about someone who disagreed with the Rav. And also, actually, I was going to do this later. So let me get back to many of you were interested in Rabbi Shubo. You can read about Rabbi Shubo in, Inside the Page Deka, the new edition has a nice article on him. You read about him. He also had a PhD. And it says at the end here that he was a student of Harry Wolfson. He was close to the Rav and the Boston Rebbe. Now, look what it says here. Shubo and Soloveitchik were very good friends, but despite their mutual admiration, in 1954, the Rav refused to take part in a testimonial dinner in Shubo's honor, since the event would also be celebrating the dedication of a new temple building that would have mixed seating. It's funny how they refer to the Rav here, or Soloveitchik, as the Rav, without saying who the Rav is. It just says... that's what we spoke about. Then it says, similarly, although Soloveitchik delivered a moving eulogy at Shubo's funeral, he would not enter the temple building. That's something new. Never heard of that Rabbi Soloveitchik delivered a moving eulogy at Shubo's funeral. Well, if you look in the article that's referenced here, this is Seth Farber, Reproach, Recognition, and Respect, Rabbi Joseph E. Soloveitchik and Orthodoxy's Mid-Century Attitude Towards Non-Orthodox Denominations. I have the article here. You learn all about Rabbi Soloveitchik and his relationship with the non-Orthodox. You even learn how in 1937, Rabbi Soloveitchik shared a podium with Mishkan Tefillah's rabbi, Herman Rubinovitz, that's a conservative rabbi, and a leading reform rabbi in a demonstration of communal unity. This took place in the auditorium, not the sanctuary, the auditorium of Mishkan Tefillah. And so you get all the Rav's ideas on this in this article. And yet, if you look on page 194, what Farber says is that Rabbi Soloveitchik attended Shubo's funeral, although he didn't enter the temple building. So I asked Seth Farber today. He said he stood out on the street. Where do they get this idea that he said any eulogy at the funeral. Well, that's because they heard that Durov gave a eulogy, but the eulogy was actually not at the funeral. That's a mistake in the encyclopedia there. So the Rav went to the funeral. He stood in the, he stood outside showing respect. Then he gave a eulogy. So what can I tell you about this eulogy? Well, and I thank David for reminding me of this. I had to, I forgot it appeared in, Chakira a few issues ago. This very interesting article by Jonah Steinmetz, Rav Soloveitchik and Rav Shubel. A eulogy rediscovered, a friendship reexamined, a whole discussion of this. So you can read it all about, let me read you some of what is said in this eulogy. The Rav, but before I do that, so the Rav gave a eulogy for Rabbi Shubel. If you look on this article on page 4, it says the transcript of the eulogy is undated. As indicated by the text, the eulogy was delivered during the Shoshim period on the opening night of Slichos. In 1969, this is Saturday night. Okay, so let me show you something now, which this is a bit of a treat here, I think, to show you. Here is the text of the invitation. Dear friend, we will assemble for an evening of remembrance and appreciation of a loyal and dedicated friend and distinguished communal leader, Rabbi Dr. Joseph S. Shubel, at my Maimonides School on Saturday evening, September 6, 1969, at 9 o'clock. Rabbi Dr. Joseph E. Soloveitchik will speak, signed Samuel C. Feuerstein. So amazing. So where did I get that from? I got that from the Bede Deutsch, is actually the great-granddaughter, the marathoner. Her mother, Vivian Robin, she gave that to me. Because I contacted her after the class. I wanted to get more details. She gave that to me. So here we see the Rav giving a eulogy in Maimonides for a conservative rabbi, threading the needle. He can't say anything positive about conservative Judaism, but he can recognize Rabbi Shubel's contribution for people who are not Torah Jews. Is it threading the needle? It definitely is. But let me read you some passages and ask yourself, would an Orthodox rabbi today give such a eulogy? And remember what we saw last week, how the Rav says, I have great admiration for Rabbi Shubel, but I just can't, you know, go into the synagogue, be involved with the synagogue. This is some of the things he says. By the way, Jonah Steinmetz in his introduction says there is much to glean from this relationship. I pray the reader finds this section informative and inspirational. He has a section dealing with his friendship. Let me just read you a few things the Rav says. You understand, therefore, that I will not be concerned with Joseph Shalom Shubel as Tselem, with the public image of Joseph Shalom Shubel as spiritual leader, as orator and preacher, as champion of many humane and worthy causes, as generous benefactor. For Joseph Shubel, as he says, you know all this. So he's not going to focus on that aspect. He's going to focus on who he is as a person. He speaks about how his involvement with Zionism. He mentions that Rabbi Shubel was a majestic figure. Now, it's granted, you could say, well, he's not talking about his role as a rabbi. He's talking about him as an individual, and he is. But let's not forget, Rabbi Shubel was a rabbi. That's where he showed his majesty. So I don't think most Orthodox rabbis would agree to a eulogy like this. Rabbi Sachs, remember the trouble he got in, that he refused to go to the funeral of the Reform rabbi, the Holocaust survivor, Hugo Grin in England. We're not talking about giving a eulogy. We're talking about attending it. He talks about Rabbi Shubel championing the most unpopular cause if he felt society was wrong. Listen to this. He could also defend an individual whom society indicted on hearsay and condemned on false evidence without a due process of law. I myself owe him an eternal gratitude for coming to my help at a time when I was lonely, the victim of a slanderous campaign conducted by a group which was out to destroy me physically and spiritually. He says that Rabbi Shubel wrote fiery articles which cleaned the air and saved my honor and dignity. This is he's talking about the Kashrus Machlokas in the 1940s, of which Orthodox rabbis, some non-Orthodox, but also Orthodox rabbis were allied against the Rav, including one in particular, who becomes a real great Talmud Chacham. But Rabbi Shubel, actually, after the fact, what did he do? He wrote a whole report on this. Hapardes, published by Agudas Rabbanim. Hapardes publishes Rabbi Shubo's final article summing up Judge Cohen's ruling, his judgment, I should say, about Rabbi Soloveitchik. Judge Cohen came to the conclusion that all these allegations and denunciations were false, and the people knew they were false. And so here you have, it's the only time Hapardes ever printed a conservative rabbi's piece. Amazing. So the Rav had also had good reason for being grateful for Rabbi Shubo. But you might say, well, the MS is the MS. The Satmar Rebbe had good reason for being grateful to the Zionists for saving him. But that didn't mean he had to praise them, and he didn't, because he said, yes, he's thankful they saved him, but it doesn't mean he's going to praise them for anything else they did. And then Rabbi Soloveitchik says as follows, which I recalled last week. I forgot it was in the eulogy. Let me record here another instance of Rabbi Shubo's kindness and loyalty to me I'll never forget. When my private little world was destroyed, and I found myself sitting on a pile of ashes and smoldering debris, submerged in a rootless desolation and numbness, such as I could not even cry out in despair and grief, Rabbi Shubo emerged like a friend and comrade. On that cursed evening on which she was taken away from me, his wife, Shubo came immediately to my home, where the hostess, dead, took up the center of the parlor. He sat down beside the Aron, the whole night reciting Tillim, not being able to hide his tears. I sat with him, dozing and waking up time after time to his rhythmic recital. He spent the night with me. Whenever in the sick anguish of my heart, in speechless, incommunicable sorrow, I think of that black, dreadful, weird night, I see Joseph Shubo. So here you have a man who sits with the Rav, the night says to him with the Rav, a dear friend of his. Basically, I think what the Rav is saying, that Joseph Shubo is a tzaddik. He's a tzaddik in any way, every way perhaps, except that the way he ran his synagogue, he was not a tzaddik. But everything else he is. And the Rav's admiration. He says, we have to go on living, but it'll be lonelier. It's difficult to imagine Boston without Rabbi Shubo. And incidentally, Rabbi Shubo is not ordained at the seminary. He's ordained at the Jewish Institute of Religion. That's Stephen Wise's institution. So that ordained Reform rabbis, although you had people who took, they didn't require you to be a Reform rabbi. You could take a traditional type synagogue conservative. So I happen to think this is inspiring. When people talk about the turn to the right, I don't think you could deny a turn to the right in that, yes, you might have certain Orthodox rabbis who would give a eulogy for a non-Orthodox rabbi, but would you have any of such a stature as Rabbi Soloveitchik? Would you have even of second or third level? Would you have any poskim, any Rosh Yeshiva from our world to do this? It's worth noting. Okay, before we continue with the Mechitza, we'll get to Marvin Fox. I want to tell you, though, about Rav Hinken, because we see this is the 50s, so we see the Rav's position, but the Rav is still a young man. He's only 51 years old, 52 years old when he's launching this battle, speaking about this. He's not the posek of America. I think at that time, the greatest posek would be Rav Hinken, and Rav Moshe would soon be on the scene. And the Rav, he's a Rosh Yeshiva, he has Talmidim, but he's not the posek of America or anything like that. Rav Hinken had a different approach. And Rav Hinken says, I want to read this to you. This is in Rav Hinken's Collected Writings, Volume 2. He says that you should have to find a place to daven, a kosher place. He says, let's say the synagogue is mekulkal. This is page 11, volume 2 of Kisvei Rebbe Hinken. Let's say the place, the synagogue, is mekulkal. Why? There's taruvos in nashim, men and women sitting together. And then he says, kvar horu bazeh, that is, the rabbis have already ruled that it's better to daven by yourself. So this isn't the Rav's idea that you should daven by yourself. The Rav was the first one to go so far to say, even to hear Tkiyas HaShofar. I don't know if the other Rabbanim would agree with the Rav. I don't know if they disagree. As far as I know, they never speak about it. But what does Rav Hinken say? If there's no other place, though, if there's no other shul, you're living in a place where the only shul, your shul, becomes mixed seating. There's no other shul. Rav Henkin says, we have to investigate. Ad heichan magia kilkul. That is, do you have to stay home every single Shabbos? He says, on the one hand, this is a kilkul. This is a bad thing. On the other hand, if the religious, what he calls hishtatfus haksherim, if the religious still go to this synagogue, there's a tikva alatikun that maybe they can still change matters. He says, and he says, if you decide you have to go there and daven mixed seating, you should still make, you know, you still protest every time you go daven there. You should let the president and others know that this is wrong. We should have separate seating. So Rav Henkin is more moderate in this area. Rav Henkin says you shouldn't daven in mixed seating, but if that's the only shul and the alternative means it will mean that you have no davening at all. And think what this means. Every single Shabbos, not having davening, not having minyan, not having any involvement in tefillah b'tzibur. For some people, this is fine, but for others, it's not. So he says that we need to investigate how much, how bad is this going to be? How is this going to lead to? Not to mention the fact that you might be able to help them. So Rav Henkin leaves it open. I guess he would say you have to ask a shayla or something. Ad hechan magia kilkul. You know, how bad is it going to be? And I think that's what it means for you by not attending. So Rav Henkin leaves it. It could be you might say Rav Henkin's only concerned with Kiruv, that even if davening by yourself will be fine, maybe you should go there because you could bring them back. I don't know. It seems he seems to be saying that because he doesn't say it's absolutely. He says in Machon Klal. If there's no other shul, and it means you're always going to have to daven by yourself, then we need to look at it, like, which is really the worst. So I think he leaves open the option, perhaps like I told you this Talmud on the Rav said, that he would say, if you feel you need to be in a shul, find a place where there's no women next to you. Again, we're talking about shuls where everything was traditional in the sense it was a regular service, regular sitter, not egalitarian. And finally, everyone always quotes the Rav, like we saw, that you can't attend a mixed seating shul, even if you're in a shofar. But I want to show you, I want to complicate matters now. And I want to quote something from none other than Rav Schechter. And because this complicates matters, I question, you know, the Rav made these public statements, like we just saw in the newspaper, stay home. But I wonder, in a case that, like Rav Henkin was confronted with, when that was the only shul, and maybe you're not dealing with the yeshiva guy who could daven by himself. Well, most people in that era couldn't daven by themselves. That's why the shuls had chazonim, because the people couldn't daven by themselves. I wonder if privately, on individual in individual circumstances, the Rav could have been more liberal, and you, especially when you see what I'm going to quote for you now, and where he might have said that, yes, what I said is a general rule, but you're an exception, and I think you should still go to the mixed seating shul. I wonder, because he did it for his students. He told them they can go into those sort of shuls. Why? To help bring them back. So if you can do it for the klal to bring them back, if the Rav is confronted with someone who, if he doesn't go to shul, he can lose Judaism entirely, that's also... That's also Hatzalas Nefashos, Pikuach Nefesh, in a spiritual sense. So in previous years, we've dealt with this responsum by Eretz Chemda, not a liberal Orthodox place, in which they ruled that someone who couldn't go to shul, couldn't walk anymore to shul, that he could go in a camp. That is, he could arrange to be brought to shul by a non-Jew, it's a Durabanan, in a shus to shus, in kum mitzvah, you're just getting in, he's taking you, it's a shus, they said that once a month you shouldn't go to make a difference, but Eretz Chemda paskent halacha l'maisa, that you could be brought to shul if you feel that you need to be in shul. You can't be by yourself the whole time. So I don't know. Would our rabbis in America paskin that way? But that's the sort of decision that I wonder if the Rav would give. So what am I referring to? Well, if you look in Yeshiva University, Yeshiva Subzochanan has a Torah annual thing comes out every year, every other year, called Beis Yitzchak. going back many years. I like looking at the old issues. You can see the old issues on HebrewBooks.org or on Otzar Chachma, because like I go to like the issues in the 90s and the early 2000s, the 80s. You see the names of people who now are sometimes they're renowned Rosh Yeshiva, other times they're pulpit rabbis. It's interesting to see that. So Rav Schechter has an article in 2006, Beis Yitzchak, pages 25 and 26. And let me tell you what it says in this article. And he says he heard the following from Rav Zerubbabel Shusheim. I don't know Zichrono Ivracha. I don't know. Someone in the comments can tell me who Rav Zerubbabel, I guess that's not his English name, Shusheim was. But this is the story. How this can go together with what we just saw from the Rav, I don't think it can go together unless we adopt the approach I said that the Rav distinguished between public statements and individual rulings. Just like the story I told you about the Rav student, he clearly says you can't go to shuls that are mixed seating. But in this specific case where it was the son of the rabbi, he gave answer. Okay, this Rabbi Shusheim was a young student learning for smicha. And the practice was that students, to make money, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur would go take positions, shtelas, at these places that needed, that didn't have rabbis, but Rosh Hashanah, of course, they wanted a rabbi. Yeah. He asked Rabbi Soloveitchik, maybe he could help him find a position in Boston. And the Rav said to him, in an Orthodox or a conservative synagogue? That's what Rav Schechter has. I don't think that's what the Rav would have said. I think what he said was a synagogue with a machitza or non-machitza. And Rav Schechter has translated that into Orthodox or conservative. I am certain the Rav is not sending people into conservative synagogues, but it's a synagogue, machitza or non-machitza. And he says, because you know you can make more, well, he says in a conservative synagogue. But again, I think he's not referring to what we consider conservative. I think he means synagogue without machitza, which looks just like a conservative synagogue, but technically, if they would have belonged to the OU, it would have been technically at least an Orthodox synagogue. So this Rav Zerubbabel asked him, Rebbe, can I daven in such a synagogue where everyone's sitting mixed seating? And the Rav replies, he says, Lefi dati, and I say this, he said into me in Yiddish, with complete understanding of all the consequences of my words, one who davens in a shul that men and women sit together is as if you're praying in a church. That's what the Rav says. Then the Rav says, but I know that there are those rabbis, Talmidei Chachamim, who don't agree with me in this matter. And Rav Schechter, in his parentheses, says as follows, because in those years, there were many synagogues that took down the machitzas and had mixed prayers. And the rabbis of these synagogues, Rabbaneim, hayu Talmidei Chachamim in Europe. They were Talmidei Chachamim from Europe, and they didn't leave the synagogues. We have synagogues with European Talmidei Chachamim that the synagogue decided to take it down, and the rabbi had no other parnassah, and he remained as the rabbi, even with them exceeding. Or sometimes they kept. We're going to see what happened in Columbus, Ohio, in a minute. Therefore, the Rav says, getting back to the Rav now, I say to you, if you want to rely on those other people, I will help you get a mixed seating congregation. If you want to rely on my opinion, I will help you get an Orthodox, a separate seating. And then Rav Schechter in parentheses says that the view of the Shar HaMelech is known, that if one person holds like the Mekilim, that if someone is Mako, even though I am Machmir, it's not considered lifnei either to help the other person. If I hold that this is usher, but this other rabbi holds it's mutter, and I help the other person do it, I'm not guilty of lifnei either because he can rely on that. So here we have a story where the Rav says that if you want a pulpit, I'll help you get a pulpit, even though it's a mixed seating pulpit. How could the rabbi be in a mixed-in congregation? So you can make all sorts of taich as well. If the rabbi was able, if the Rav could send his talmidim, why couldn't he send these guys? But these guys were not there to make it to separate seating. These guys were just there to make a buck over Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, give a couple sermons. So it's not like when the Rav sent his talmidim out there. So it's a what it shows you is that the Rav was, although he himself was very strong, confronted with a situation like that, he was, for on a temporary basis, he was willing to compromise. or he was, well, not compromise, he was willing to recognize the legitimacy of the other side, that, you know, look, these people need rabbis. If I don't send them, then the conservative rabbis are going to go there. And that's also the case by the Russian Yom Kippur. If all the Orthodox rabbis would adopt the Rav's position, you know who would go to these shuls? The seminary would send people to these shuls. So we see here the Rav is, I guess, more liberal than you'd expect. And now let's turn to this. Let's turn to the case that I wrote about. First, about Marvin Fox again. There's people, I'm sure, listening who knew Marvin Fox. I have to confess to something, and I'm not proud of it. None of us should be proud of it at Brandeis, but I was there 4 years as a student. I worked there 3 years. I was the equivalent of the JLIC rabbi before they had JLIC. Here we had Marvin Fox with us. He comes from Ohio State to Brandeis, I guess in the 70s, you know, a leading Orthodox thinker, writer. We never took advantage of him. Here we are. We're having Shabbatons or bringing in these speakers, these Orthodox speakers. We have talks during the evening. And of course, we have to pay these speakers. Here we have Marvin Fox on campus. And he would speak for free, obviously. That would have saved us money. We never took advantage of him. I'm embarrassed to say this. I should have known better, certainly. I mean, I spoke to him, but I didn't speak to him that much. One time I spoke to him, he told me, make sure not to give away any of the letters of Rabbi Weinberg I have, that make sure I keep them close. I mean, in fact, the only time I recall in all the years on campus that there were Marvin Fox, people were even talking about him, was in one of his classes. This is when I was working there. And he was giving a teaching on Jewish ethics. In those days, he had many yeshiva students, everything. So that he assigned to them Rav Lichtenstein's famous essay, Is There a Jewish Ethic Independent of Halakha? And Fox devoted the whole class basically to taking it apart. He had a whole different position on natural law. He even went so far as to say, I don't know how Rav Aaron Lichtenstein could have said such nonsense, something like that. And that's a classic essay. But the point is that it's embarrassing for me to say that we had Marvin Fox with us, and we just didn't take advantage. It's like the New Testament says, Ain't Navi Be'iro. You know, you're not that Marvin Fox needed us. We didn't give him any kavod, but we should have known that we never to ask him. We had Shabbatons, and we'd invite this rabbi and that rabbi, and we could have even used him to discuss halachic matters. All sorts of questions came up. I could have consulted with him. I never did. The only time he ever spoke to the Orthodox group is when we dedicated the Beis Medrash. This would have been 1994. If you know Brandeis in Shapiro Dormitory at the bottom, I spoke in the classes on my latest book. We spoke about this. So we dedicated a Beis Medrash, the first Beis Medrash outside of YU, I guess, in Toro, in any American university. And Marvin Fox, the students asked him to speak. I'm not even sure who asked him to speak, because I didn't ask him to speak, and I was the rabbi. So it's unfortunate that we didn't. Let me tell you one thing Marvin Fox said, though, because it relates to the Rav. He knew the Rav very. He was very close to the Rav, and when he moved to Boston, very close to the Turskys. Marvin Fox asked the Rav once, did you wear a yarmulke when you were at the University of Berlin? And the Rav replied as follows, quote, it would have been inconceivable. Marvin Fox was on I wrote my senior thesis on Rabbi Chaim of Weinberg, so he was on the committee. So we got in a bit of a dispute. He challenged something I wrote, and I responded. And of course, in retrospect, when I look at it, of course he was right. I mean, and who was I arguing with? I'm a little twerp, 21 years old, and I'm trying to argue a point with, you know, I use the phrase extra halachic. I should have used meta-halachic, and Marvin Fox was saying, why is that not part of how the halacha system includes all this? And I'm arguing with him, and what chutzpah I had, you know, I'm not the Rav at age 21, and I'm arguing with Marvin Fox, and whatever. So he was a great man, and he did serve in a rabbinic role, because the shul, Shari Tfila now, Rabbi Samuel's shul in Newton, before they had a rabbi, they had a rabbinic triumvirate. They had Marvin Fox, Professor Alexander Altman, and they had one other person, and they were they made the decisions. This gets us to the Columbus. We'll speak a few minutes about it. Next week, we'll really get into it. Marvin Fox was at Ohio State, Musmach of Chicago, later it was called Skokie. And I'm going to read you the letters of Marvin Fox, and you're going to see what happens in Columbus. that Orthodoxy, what's happening to Orthodox shuls? And Fox turns to the Rav. I found these papers in the Brandeis University archives, the Marvin Fox collection. Actually, now that I mention archives, I also have to tell you that the letter of Rabbi Shubo, which is in Helfgott to Rabbi Shubo, Helfgott's book, it actually was first published by Seth Farber in that article I mentioned. So Seth Farber, everyone quotes it as appearing in the Helfgott book. Seth Farber should be given credit. So I found these things in the archive, the Brandeis, the Fox archive. Bekitzer, in short, they were getting rid of the mechitza. There was the shul that Fox davened at. They built a new building, Agudas Achim, it was called in Columbus, and they got rid of the mechitza. So what's he supposed to do? Before we even get to the Rav, what did I find in the Fox archives? I find this letter, a letter from a Mordechai Gifter. I had no idea that Marvin Fox, it makes sense in Ohio, he's in Columbus. Columbus is the biggest city in Ohio, by the way, that he would be connected to Rabbi Gifter over in Cleveland. He writes, I don't have his letter to Rav Gifter, but here you have Rav Gifter's reply. He calls him Yedidi. You know, Hanala Vanichbad, Dr. Moshe Zev Fox. And he tells them, as you can imagine, that you can't, he says, Rav Gifter says, a shul without a machitza, it's not a base tefillah, it's base taiva. Mispal sham tefillaso toeva. And then he says that not only is it the problem if there's mixed pews, but even if it doesn't have a kosher mechitza. Okay, so that's something you'd expect from Rav Gifter. But then it goes on. This is what I want to share with you. We'll start it, but we'll get next class. I found in the archives a letter, a Hebrew draft of a letter from Fox to the Rav. I don't think he actually sent this, because the Rav replies to him in English. So I think in the end he sends an English letter, but we'll get the whole story about Orthodoxy in Columbus. Anyone who's interested in Columbus or is from Columbus, you're going to love this. But then we have another letter I found in the archives to the Rav dealing with the same situation a couple of years later. You'll see fascinating questions. And then a letter from Fox to the so-called Orthodox Rabbi of Columbus. I apologize if we have any descendants of Rabbi Rubinstein, but you'll see how Fox is telling him that your shul basically is not an Orthodox shul anymore, and what the problems are, and why I can't daven there, and these, after we see exactly, and we'll also see Rabbi Greenwald, Yekusiel Yehuda Greenwald, who was in Columbus. What was he doing while Orthodoxy was just disappearing in Columbus? Then we'll see the Rav's reply to Marvin Fox. So that'll be next class. We'll definitely finish the letters next class. This was number 10, I believe. We're 10 or 9. I think this is 10, I think. But we're not done, because then, I don't know either, Rabbi Kelman, because then I got to give you the letter that wasn't published because Hakira didn't want to publish it. And that you've been wondering all these weeks, what could it possibly be that Hakira didn't want to publish? Maybe you agree they shouldn't publish it. We'll get to it. It's a halachic letter. Okay. Barry says, or Rabbi Hartman, I should say, Rabbi Rothkopf, or Kefet, in a lecture said he was able to get him put into the Reitz history. He was saved by Dr. Revel from Telsch, where he learned in 1940. Oh, so Rabbi Rakefet must mean that in his memoir, From Washington Street to whatever it's called, he talks a lot about Rabbi Volk, and he really portrays the tragedy of Rabbi Volk, who had not been the Holocaust, you know, what he could have become. He never really was able to find himself. But he also was, I have to say it, he also was jealous of the Rav. Rabbi Volk, who was a great Talmud Chacham, a Telzer, who didn't like the Telzers, the Rabbi Gifter group in Cleveland, he thought they distorted it. But Rabbi Rakefet tells the story how once, there's a lot of commotion because they were bringing in this recording equipment. It's not like today with little tapes. They had, big machine to record the Rav. And Rabbi Volk says, why are they recording the Rav? Why not me? I also went to the gymnasium. So, there's a difference between, PhD University of Berlin and the gymnasium that they had in Telz. But you see the tragedy here of Rav Volk. But I will show you what exactly I was the first one to write about this. I'm not saying I discovered it because other people probably saw it, but I'll show you what the Rav Volk said. And it's unfortunate. Look, it's in the Sefer. It's public knowledge, but there's bitterness there, and it's unfortunate. But that doesn't mean that Yeshayahu Shmuel Zalchanan should simply remove him from their institutional history. He was part and parcel of Yeshayahu Shmuel Zalchanan. In fact, Rabbi Rachman told me that he was very friendly with Rabbi Volk. Rabbi Kelman says it's important to note that the Rav was talking to a frum person. He would not have said to a non-religious Jew who goes to the temple 3 times a year. Yes, I agree with Rabbi Kelman. Rav Lichtenstein writes, how can we honestly think that these people who go to temple, or a conservative reform temple, that they're better off not be going to anywhere? Look at the Israelis who come to America who have no connection, zero. Obviously, we accept that, although we think so. I had this argument with the Rosh Hashiva of Yeshiva Chevron, the late Rabbi Sarna, not Yecheskel Sarna, his son. I said he thought that, no, it's better not to go to anything because then you're a tabula rasa. And I guess we could fill it with Torah. I said, everyone in America knows that if you are totally assimilated, there's no connection to Israel, no reason to marry Jewish, nothing. He could not see my point. He thought that conservative and reform, it's ziofa Torah. So it's better than no Torah. And he couldn't. I don't think even a Haredi rabbi in America would agree with Rabbi Sarna. I think they understand. They're sophisticated enough. Look, all the best Balei Tshuva come out of the conservative movement. That's like their prime hunting grounds, as it were. Paul says, what is the status of the many Orthodox synagogues where Sefer Torah is carried on the other side of Mechitza when it's taken out, returned to the Aron Kodesh? Well, look, that could be a dispute in Orthodoxy. That doesn't destroy the Kedushas Beis HaKnesses. There's still a Mechitza. A man is allowed to walk through the woman's side if he needs to get somewhere. Sometimes women walk through the end. It might be mius. It might be mukza machas mius. It might be distasteful and all sorts of things. There's times when some Orthodox shuls where they actually give the woman the Sefer Torah to carry, and then she gives it to the man at the end. These are, you know, trying to give some leeway to Orthodox feminists. The people in shuls like that don't say this should be done in every shul. They say, but in this shul, it should be done. And I can tell you that this was a big issue at Brandeis, incidentally, when I was a student there. I spoke about this in one of the early classes, and the rabbi banned it, and then we got a new rabbi, and he permitted it. But it's it doesn't destroy the Kedusha Space at Knesset. It's an issue of minhag beis haKnesses, things like that. And Rabbi Kelman says, you must recall that in the 50s, people thought they were the last generation of Orthodoxy. So it's impossible to extrapolate. I don't know. Well, I don't think they thought they were the last generation. I thought that they thought the last, they assumed there'd be small pockets. They'd remain. But they were not going to be the dominant form of religion. If you go to the early 20th century.
My aunt told me that was it. They were it. There's going to be nobody left after them. Of course, I'm not saying her view is, but I remember my aunt telling me we were it. Orthodoxy was going to come to an end and couldn't survive after the war in America and everything. It's just interesting.
Well, I heard from Rabbi David Feldman from Tina, the leading conservative rabbi, but huge Talmud Chacham. He told me the reason. He told me this the weekend I was together with him in Toronto when it came up that weekend. And call a kavod to Torah Nushin to bring him, because other groups might not have. But he just look at his children that he raised, and you'll see what type of, where his values were. But he told me that he went, when he left the yeshiva world to go to the Orthodox world, to go to the seminary, he thought that we all assumed that that was the future. And that's where we would build like Torah Judaism, but it would be a different Torah Judaism. But he thought there was no future, and he saw, you know, 40 years later that was a big mistake. And had he remained in the Orthodox world, David Feldman would have been. You think of people like Rav Schechter and Rabbi Bleich and all these. Let me not put Rav Schechter in there because he doesn't really write. He's just a Torah scholar. But people like Rabbi Bleich and others who write on halacha in the English language, David Feldman would be one of the leading intellectual voices in Orthodoxy had he remained. So it's a big loss. Rabbi Kelman, a private comment. I don't know, I didn't know what you said. Justin says, at various times, the idea of being hosting stranger guests for Shabbos Yom Tov was not what we are used to. Different gestalt mindset. But I don't know. You know, if the Rav, you had lots of wealthy balabatim with all sorts of guest rooms. We're dealing with a case. Maybe the guy's living across the country. Maybe he can't come back, whatever it is. But 99 out of 100 times where you had a situation like that, for if you needed to hear a shofar, you could get set up somewhere. Someone privately says maybe the person hoped the Rav would allow him to enter the conservative synagogue and thereby enable him to stay home in Brookline or wherever he was. But once he said no, he maybe did relocate. Okay, so you're right. We don't know the end of the story. Maybe the guy wanted to stay in his community, and when the Rav said no, I never thought of that. Thank you for pointing it out. Then he had to say, okay, well, then now I need to find a place. But that's a pain in the neck. He has to go to somewhere. He has to get a hotel room or go to someone. Maybe that was the whole point of the question, that he wanted the heter so he didn't have to leave and the Rav didn't give it to him. But the flip side of that is maybe if there was no, that if there really was no other way to go, the Rav would have permitted it. Herb says, he quotes one of the early Christian saints, that let men be men and women with women. Okay, it's hard for me to read that whole thing now. So Augustine described the chastity displayed in the church of his time and used the separate seating of men and women as an example. Well, the churches used to be separate seating. That's why in Germany there was separate seating, even in the Reformed synagogues, until after World War I. As we said on many occasions, the first mixed seating synagogue was in America, Isaac Mayer Wise in Albany. Thank you for that, Herb. Nissen says, in his comparative sociology, Senator Robert Byrd in December of 72 stood outside the Catholic Church in pouring rain in Wilmington, Delaware, to honor his new colleague, Joseph Biden. He couldn't attend the funeral inside because his Baptist church conference forbade it. However, okay. Listen, there's a rabbi in Washington Heights. It's a davar yaduah, so I can mention it, but I won't. When Rabbi Ram, who was one of the Rosh Hashiva at YU, died, this rabbi of Washington Heights stood outside YU to give kavod acharon to Rabbi Ram, but he refused to step into YU because some Breuer's people have like a quasi-cherem on going in there. So Rabbi Kelman gives about Rabbi Mervis and the upcoming coronation of King Charles. I got to see the pictures, the video of this. This is in a church. This thing is taking place in a church. So
he's going into the church. You'll see in the article. And when Jonathan Sachs was in Toronto, we asked him that question, and he told us when the Queen invites him, they go to churches. They go mamish inside the church.
On Shabbos. Like, yes, yes. Shabbos too. Yes. It was on Shabbos coronation.
It's also Shabbos, but it's going to be in the morning.
The king is putting him up in the royal, in a royal residence. That I knew already.
I don't know if he's not going to have a minion. It's going to be in the morning.
No, he's going to have a marble arch. You'll read the article.
Marble arch. What time is the coronation?
A one or something. You'll see.
Okay. I'll check it out.
Yeah.
Okay. If the Rav, Marty says, if the Rav was entirely consistent, wouldn't he have also banned people from sitting in shul with people of their own sex if they were close friends? Well, then how are you going to sit and show? It's a good question. But then, or you could say if you're gay. I mean, what are you supposed to do? But look, the Torah, as the Rambam says, speaks al derech harov. You know, and you can always find exceptions on this matter. But the Rav's point, I don't know why the Rav doesn't focus on the sexual angle. The sexual tension that now we're in shul, we should just be focused on davening. Instead, he focuses on like the family, that we're not supposed to be a family, we're not supposed to be connected to our loved ones, we're only supposed to be focused on God. Only the Rav speaks like that. Everyone else focuses on, you know, the sexual angle, which I think is the pshat. Paul says, for the record, Rabbi Sachs did not get into trouble for not attending the funeral. He was out of town. He and his wife attended. He got into trouble for agreeing to give a hesped at a memorial meeting. The meeting was a non-religious event, arranged at a neutral venue. The Haredi based and attacked him as soon as the event was announced. Okay, Paul, before I go further, he got into trouble with the non-Orthodox by not going to the funeral. And then he got into trouble with the non-Orthodox for sending that letter that you referred to, where he spoke about Rabbi Grin as Oso Ha'ish and spoke about him in negative ways. And then that was leaked by the Haredim. And this was not who Jonathan Sacks was, but you see him writing to the Haredi Av Beis Din there in a way saying, well, I sort of had to do this and putting down Rabbi Grin. And so that got him in trouble again. So he got in trouble with the Haredim, and then he got in trouble with non-Orthodox. But I do recall by not attending the funeral, people saw it as a sign of weakness, not being able to stand up to them. I just spoke about this, incidentally, with they're doing a biography, like an official biography of Rav Sacks. And because I wrote my essay on Rav Sacks' controversy with the Dignity of Difference, they wanted to speak to me. And it's actually going to be, even though it's like a court biography, they're actually going to deal with all these issues. They're not going to put anything under the rug. I was very impressed. Yana says, what would the Rav say about people who pose transgender? I have no idea. I have no idea. These questions were not even imaginable 5 years ago, never mind, or 10 years ago, I should say, never mind the days of the Rav. Look, the Rav has very harsh things to say about homosexuality, which I think if you assume today that, as I think we do, that people are born like this, I don't think you would have those same sort of rhetoric. The halacha remains the same, but the rhetoric, at least I think most people would be more in line with Rabbi Lamb, even Rav Aaron Feldman, or the new piece by Rabbi Brander, the way the Rav speaks. But again, you're talking in the 60s, the 70s. It was all thought to be hedonism, and it's a different world. But if you go to the the YouTube chat, just go to Torah in Motion's YouTube channel. The first thing that pops up is the Torah in Motion conference a number of years ago on this matter, and you'll see good discussions of this, but it's far apart from where we can go now. Rabbi Kalman says that you recall Raina, he didn't sit next to his father. That's interesting. I'd like to know whether
I have to look if it's an ish halacha or not, but I absolutely recall reading that the Rav said Einachinami, he did not sit with his father, and that was common practice. I just have to find it now, you know. I don't think I'm mistaken, but of course I could be. But okay, I'm going to look for it after the class.
And Eli or Ellie says that he grew up in a well-known Orthodox shul in the Bronx, which had a women's gallery, but on high holidays it had mixed seating, and the rabbi was a prominent Orthodox rabbi. Justin said that Professor Fox spoke at Hill and other events at Brandeis in the 70s and 80s. That's interesting for me to hear, Justin. I came to Brandeis in 85, and I was there from 85 to 93. He never spoke at Hillel and never spoke. I ran the Orthodox community, as the rabbi of it for 3 years, and I was one of the very involved in it for the 4 years I was there. We never had him come. We never had Reuven Kimmelman come. What can I say?
They were popular items when I was there, late 70s, early 80s.
Okay, maybe that says something about the change. I don't know, the change in the population of students. We had definitely more yeshiva students in my time than you did, and we had a more Orthodox element, but that shouldn't have changed it. It's just like that we didn't recognize them. It's just that no one really knew who he was, the history, and his involvement and as an Orthodox thinker. We should have known it, but we didn't. And
sometimes he kept a low profile, actually, across the university for, who knows, political other reasons. I think that might be a part
fine,
of it.
But we should have asked him. Had we asked him, he would have come. Rabbi Yellen points out that on the stationery of Rev Gifter, Professor Rabbinical College of Telsh. Yes, that is interesting. I guess that gives a kavod to the institution. Okay, a couple more. Yes, so Nissen says that Professor Fox had the article. Is there an ethic in Penavalcha in the anthology? Of course he knew it well, but he didn't agree with it. And I believe in his book is his use. I don't know if he ever really writes about it per se. He has an article about natural law where he refers to it, and you see he opposes it. But of course, this is a Mechanta Shel Torah. But I remember all the students were talking about this, that how Fox went off on Rav Aaron. Okay, final. These were Gedolim Asher Ba'aretz. What can I say? These were great people. It's often the case you don't appreciate them when you have them. Finally, Gershon asks, who was the person to whom the Rav said it would be inconceivable for a Jew to wear a yarmulke at University of Berlin? It was to Marvin Fox. In fact, Rav Schechter records in one of his volumes that when Rav Lichtenstein went for his interview at Harvard, he told Rav Aaron not to wear a yarmulke. Maybe there's going to be an anti-Semite there or something. Rav Aaron wore the yarmulke, which is unusual. But in Berlin, I told you in the past, or you can see in my book, Changing the Immutable, I have a picture. I've shown it in the past of a wedding in Frankfurt. In Frankfurt, they're very firm. The women wear shadels. The women in shadels, this is outdoor picture. The men all bareheaded. We all know that in Germany, they did not wear, even for the secular studies at the Jewish day schools, they took off the yarmulke. So, of course, at the University of Berlin. But those were his words. The Bazaar Lashon, it would have been inconceivable. Thank you all. This finishes our 10th class.
Rabbi, one question. Yeah. So far, you'd say, outside the shul, you do not have to be in the synagogue.
Exactly. So that was the question.
So why
asked
nobody
Raparnas,
sent it to him?
Okay, I asked Rabbi Parnas this question. And Raparnas says that this was a Harat, Raparnas, who's hardly on the left. He's about as right wing as you can get, but he's a close Talmud of the Rav. From the Talmidim of the Rav, I mean, he's on the right. I shouldn't say as right-wing as you can get, but I mean, he's on the right. He said that this was Hora'at Sha'ah. This wasn't just standard halacha. Standard halacha, you'd say, like you said. He said this was an emergency measure, and he said only a Godel like the Rav has the authority to say, don't hear Tkiyas HaShofar, because only a Godel like the Rav, or a Moshe Feinstein, whatever, could see the broader picture that... we see the forest, they see the trees. That's what Raparnas said, that this was an emergency measure from the Rav, and only a gadol like the Rav could say that. So you are right, but that's not...
He could have told him to stay the other side of the road.
Okay, but you can't hear it outside. Most synagogues, you can't hear shofar outside. So you would have to. So you could say, well, you could stay in the lobby, and you could hear it. You know what? Maybe that would have been a solution, but that's not what the Rav was making a point. You're right. Maybe the Rav, after he says this, could have come up with all the possibilities, you know, ask him to open the window, stand outside. But this could only be maybe even all theoretical. But the Rav is saying that it's worse to enter a conservative synagogue. If you're going to miss the Kesher Shofar, stay home. When you hear that, that shows you, not conservative, mixed seating. That shows you how important it is. If the Rav Soloveitchik tells you, rather give up Tkiyas HaShofar from Rosh Hashanah, then you might not have to ever give it up. You can come up with solutions. But the fact that he tells you it's more important to give up Tkiyas HaShofar than to go into a mixed seating synagogue, that shows you the gravity that this is not a synagogue. It has no Kedusha Space HaKnesses. And that's more important than whether or not technically you can listen to Tkiyas HaShofar. He's saying that stepping into that building is worse. That is, it's worse to step in that building. And if it means that you can't even hear Tkiyas HaShofar, better give up Tkiyas HaShofar. Because a mitzvah say to rest Tkiyas HaShofar doesn't even rise to the level of legitimizing this kafira rabim. That's his position.
Thank you.
Rav Henkin, we saw a different view, but that's the Rav. Okay. Rabbi Kelvin.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. Very good. We look forward to next week, please God. Okay. Tomorrow, of course, Dr. Sokolow and Rabbi Shulman. Wednesday, Rabbi Helfgott. Thursday, Marty Lakshman. We're starting a three-part series on the Aseret HaDibrot back after a little bit of a hiatus. That'll be on Thursday. We'll send out, email about that. And then the Parsha Shir this week by Rabbi Shaul Robinson of Lincoln Square Synagogue. And I guess I finished the week on the Siddur class. And we look forward to learning with you. Please invite a friend to join us. Everybody be well. And it's your good things. Okay. Laila Tov, everybody. And David and Beit Shemesh, Boker Tov. Okay. Everybody else, Laila Tov. Okay. Laila Tov. Thank you very much, everybody. Be well. Okay.
Mark, are you still there? Is Mark still there?
I don't think so.
Why don't you tell people about your new podcast?
Okay, why don't you? That's right. Okay, so J.J. Kimke, who's doing a post fellowship at Harvard University, has started a new podcast for us where he interviews really fascinating people every few weeks. And thank you, Mel, and thank you for your email the other day. So we sent out actually an email today. You can link to them. This is a real podcast. We have Mark on podcast, but this wasn't created as a podcast. These are, he interviews them. you know, there's nobody there. And then we put it together as a podcast. We're getting into that. Thank you. And I think they are fascinating. I know people have listened to them and been very, very impressed. And, well, it's a nice thing. So, thank you, Mel. And, go
ahead. I listened also. It was very good. Excellent.
Yes.
And very well produced. Very well produced.
Yeah, as you know, we try to do things professionally. Everything we do, it's best we can. So thank you. So yes, if you haven't listened, please go in your favorite podcast. I don't even know what it's called, where you download your podcast from. I don't think that's the word by podcast.
Podcast app, whichever podcast app is.
There you go. Thank you very much. Thank you for that. Okay, everybody. We have a few of them up, and we'll be releasing them in every 2-3 weeks. We'll have another one released so that you can listen to. Of course, there are over 1,000 talks on YouTube and on our audio you can listen to. We've got lots to keep you busy, lots of learning to keep you busy for a long, long time. Okay. Lila Tov, everybody. Thank you very much.